Good morning.
Morning, Your Honors.
May it please the Court. My name is Chase Brockstead, and it is an honor and a privilege to be here again today. I would like to introduce my co-trial counsel from the Bar of North Carolina, Father Daniel John Anderson.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Both men have been admitted pro hoc vice, and together we represent the plaintiffs below, appellees. Mr. Daniel will be arguing. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is John Elzafan. I represent appellants in this case. I'd like the Court to introduce the pro hoc vice admitted attorneys who will be arguing. Standing first is closest to you is Mark Aronchek, a former chancellor of the Philadelphia Bar Association, a fellow American College of Trial Lawyers, been extensively practicing the Philadelphia courts for many years, and who will be arguing on behalf of the appellants. With him is Matt Hammermesh, who was also admitted pro hoc vice and who performed the laboring on the brief. It's a pleasure to introduce them to the Court.
Thank you. Welcome to the Court. Yes, please. Before we start, before I turn on the clock, when I turn on the clock, you'll see your total time, the green light will be on. When the yellow light comes on, you'll be into the time you've reserved. You can continue speaking, but you will be using your reserve time.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. May it please the Court. First, it's an honor to be able to appear before this Court and to argue this important case. The core issue before Your Honors is how to construe the mental anguish provision of the Delaware wrongful death statute. The lower court took the most expansive reading possible, allowing the plaintiff to argue that anything that happened to Mrs. Bailey before her death or that the family learned after her death and even in the courtroom was relevant for the jury to consider as grief resulting from death, which is the standard in the wrongful death statute. Now, no case in Delaware or anywhere else has interpreted this statute that broadly, save a state like Maine, where before the statute, when the statute only said what the Delaware formula has, grief resulting from death, and the Maine court in Purdy said that limited it to the grief following death, the legislature amended and said, but we also wanted to include grief that follows from the underlying circumstances of the act. And then the Maine court said, now that's expanded because the legislature did it. But the legislature has not done that in Delaware. Now, the instructions below should have focused the jury to consider grief from death, the anguish from the loss itself. But as a result of the court's instructions, four broad categories of evidence were before the jury, and all of it was directed by the court that the jury must consider as relevant.
Before you get into that, I understand that the position that you're taking in the brief is that that mental anguish or proof of mental anguish has to be related in time to matters that took place after death, or that is to say mental anguish that can be attributed to the death itself is distinguished from anything that went before. Is that correct?
Justice Jacobs, it's even broader than that. My position is narrower, or the position I take is more extended. And what I mean is this. The mental anguish resulting from death, that's a formula in the statute. That's a but-for formula. And you need to ask, what is the grief that they wouldn't have suffered but for the death? And as then trial lawyer, now Judge Baviaris, said in a monograph that he wrote back in 1982, you ask the question, what was the relationship and the nature of the relationship before death? And what's missing as a result of the absence of that relationship?
My question is this. I note that there's one page of the appendix where you state, I don't know whether you personally or someone on your side, represents to the court verbally that as to Mr. Bailey and the three Conaway sons, our position is that it should simply be how much they miss their mother, and that she is no longer there for help. And I think that same phraseology or something similar to that is used in your brief. My question is this. Where in the record did you take that position in writing?
Well, Mr. Elzevan submitted an instruction. First, Mr. Elzevan, at the record at 727 to 737 in that sequence there, before argument and before the instructions to the jury, asked generally and submitted a proposed instruction.
Was there a brief filed? Was this argument that you're making, which is apparently a first impression, ever raised in a brief?
Well, in the...
That's a yes or no?
Yes, in this way. In the motion in limine brief, where there was a request for trifurcation or perhaps bifurcation, Mr. Elzevan said in writing that there's going to be a great deal of punitive evidence in this case that doesn't relate to the mental anguish part of the wrongful death statute. And then they argued that before the court below in the transcript, and he elaborated and said in that argument, you're going to have all these after learned bad acts, you're going to have all this consideration of their anguish before she died, but none of that should be pertinent to the wrongful death. There might be some overlap, he conceded, but nobody pursued what some means.
Well, that's a negative argument. That is, that isn't a positive statement of what your legal position is. Is it?
Well, I think it is. I mean, I think that.
Can you give me a record cite? Because we looked in the appendix and couldn't find any reference to the argument that you're making now to what was made in the court in the Superior Court, except for that one verbal statement.
Well, I can only limit it. I don't have the evidence may overlap site, but that is where I am arguing from, where Mr. Elzevan said that there may be some overlap, but there is a great deal of that there is no overlap. And then his proposed instruction, Your Honor.
Is that in the record, the proposed instruction?
Yeah, at 780, Justice Ridley, at 782 to 783.
Is it in writing? Did he submit it written?
Yes. His proposed instruction was that the there should be no discussion about whether Lewis is the appropriate place or was the appropriate place for Ms. Bailey to receive treatment. In other words, all the punitive bad act evidence that they tried to introduce shouldn't be weighed in determining mental anguish or grief as resulting from death.
Well, let me ask you a hypothetical, applying the position you're arguing for to this hypothetical case. Let's assume in the hypothetical punitive damages aren't an issue and a person is shot and left in a field to die and they live for a day and the cause of death is probably a combination of blood loss and exposure. So the family knows that their loved one spent a day in a field dying from a combination of blood loss and exposure. If your position prevails, what would be permitted with regard to mental anguish?
Mental anguish should be the jury would then be instructed, you need to consider what kind of suffering or grief, or whether the suffering or grief that they testified to or presented in the court would not have happened, but for the fact of death. And was whatever grief they are advancing closely related to the fact of death, reasonably and closely related?
Well, let's suppose there's a motion in limine, and the plaintiff says, I'd like to put in testimony that my client can't put it out of their mind that their loved one was in this field dying for a day, and that has a, you know, horrible effect on them. Will they be allowed to present that testimony to the jury?
I think that there's a close question, and probably not if it's related. Would they be allowed to present it, or would the jury be instructed on how to weigh or consider two different things?
Apply your rule.
All right, but I think that the jury would be instructed that you really have to separate in your mind what kind of grief they would have had or emotional reaction they experienced from the underlying tort, from the underlying wrongful act. And try to imagine if they would have had that anyway if the person lived, because the mental anguish that they then have to weigh is more related. It's more related to the fact that that relationship is no longer there. And the jury would then have to be instructed. Now that you know they died, weigh what that relationship was to the person and what is it now, and what is missing in it, and how has the missing affected that person. That's not a trivial issue, but it limits the grief that this statute addresses to the causal relationship to the death, not to the underlying wrongful act or what you learn later.
So, and does the plaintiff get to testify that they can't put the fact out of their mind and that their loved one was dying in a field over the course of a day?
I think that there is an argument that the court would limit that testimony if all we're talking about, if there's no negligent infliction of emotional distress count or anything like that, and it's only limited to what's the grief from the death, a court could say that is elaborating. That's not relevant to the specific issue that's at hand. If there's no survival action, if the whole case is limited just to that specific issue which this jury had to address, what is the calculus of grief from the loss?
Well, can you consider the causation of the death? I mean, the slowly bleeding to death in a field, for example?
I'm assuming in Justice Holland's hypothetical that liability has been conceded. I mean, you certainly could if you have to prove liability. And then the jury has to get a liability instruction. They have to get a damage instruction. But if liability is conceded and all we're doing is weighing the narrow but important question of what is the value of, you know, how do we value this grief from death, then you have to have a limited presentation.
Now, isn't it reasonably foreseeable that there will be mental anguish from a lingering death, for example?
Of course.
But so what is the limiting language in the statute that precludes a jury from awarding damages for that mental anguish?
The because it says from the death. And if, you know, I mean, it's going to be a factual question, no doubt, of what is the death, but in individual cases. But it's not from the injury that the underlying tort occurred. It's not from the period of mistreatment. It's not from the circumstances of how the tort occurred. From the death.
What is the significance, then, of the language in the statute, all facts and circumstances?
But relating to grief resulting from the death. It's not all facts and circumstances in the world. It's facts and circumstances pertaining, if this is the only issue that's being tried, pertaining to that issue.
Mr. Ramczyk, would your argument be different or the same if the language of the statute was wrongful death, that is, resulting from the wrongful death?
No, because the wrongfulness is what is required for liability. I mean, that is what is you need to prove in order to get into the statute.
But cutting it pretty fine, isn't it?
I don't think so, because if you go in the direction you're going, then everything comes in. You have a statute that is in derogation of the common law. Under a negligent infliction theory, for example, you could not consider all of these circumstances. You could not do that. You couldn't get any recovery for all that absent, as your court has said, physical injury, zone of danger, physical presence, all the limitations that you have put on the negligent infliction theory. Wrongful death is in derogation of that common law. Statute has to be strictly construed. You've said so. Courts have said so. Then District Judge Ross said so in the Stirner case in reviewing Delaware law. Everyone has said so. And if you go down the road of saying, well, we're going to take in all of the underlying facts and circumstances, you've opened up that door beyond it, Your Honor, beyond what any court that's faced this, and you have never faced this, obviously, but Arizona, West Virginia, Maryland, Alaska, Texas, there are two other opinions from Alaska and Texas that I would like to give you the cites that have also addressed these issues that are not in our briefs, if I could submit a letter that I could give it, but five courts.
Is it not at the crux of your case here that the Superior Court committed error in not engaging in the analysis that you've been attempting to describe to us and in instructing the jury accordingly? Is that right?
Your Honor, I don't believe that.
Is that right?
Yes, and I want a caveat. Yes, clearly, and a caveat. I don't believe there's been any waiver. I believe that there was an analysis. I believe that the Superior Court judge five times looked at the breadth of this issue and decided, I am going to instruct broadly, and told Mr. Elzevan several times in the record, all your objections are preserved. But even if none of that was so, The plain error doctrine that your court, in the Bullock case, has advanced, if there is a material error in the instruction, whether, putting aside all the issues of preservation, this court has said we're going to do justice. We're going to look at that material error. And if the court didn't get it right in instructing this jury, then we're going to look at it anyway. And if it certainly is material. I mean, what happened here, $13 million verdict, is certainly material. It flowed from that instruction.
Well, let me ask you another question, and maybe you can distinguish this and help us focus how to apply the rule you're arguing. In a second hypothetical, let's assume a person is in a healthcare facility and they receive an overdose of a drug that results in them losing consciousness and basically dying in their sleep. But it's totally peaceful. They're just killed by this overdose of a drug. And compare that to the family whose loved one was in hypothetical number one, dying in the field. You seem to be suggesting that after the point of death, you have to relate your loss to the death, and the nature of the death and how that causes you mental anguish is not relevant under the statute. Is that correct?
Yes, I do agree. I think that the issue really is evaluating the nature of the loss, not the nature of the death. I think that is what this statute says. I think that is, and Your Honors, in this record, for example, testimony such as Mr. Bailey's relationship with Mrs. Bailey before she began to suffer from Alzheimer's, when she suffered, I mean, there was already a loss at that point. What the Conway's relationship with their mother was when they were growing up, what it was in more recent times when she had Alzheimer's, their feelings and grief about that loss, the impact of learning how her body was dropped at the time of death. I mean, those kinds of things relate to the relationship and the change and the loss. In your Superior Court cases, every single one, there are four, have all addressed testimony like that, have added and said, well, let's look at life expectancies and things to determine how long those feelings are expected to linger. Those are important issues.
Dave, but is it correct that the first time your side took the position that you're taking on appeal was after the settlement of the punitive damage claim?
No, in the sense that after the settlement of the your Honors, I see I've got the sum up light and I had reserved four.
Your answer.
Okay. No, in this sense, after the settlement of punitives, Mr. Elzevan asked for a very limiting instruction of the nature that I'm presenting here and limiting argument, but it was consistent with what he had been asking for pre-trial.
Was it?
I think so, Your Honor. I mean, I understand your
paragraph
negative.
23 of your motion for separation of compensatory and punitive damages says, conversely, evidence of the impact of some of the alleged conduct which forms the punitive damage claim may be relevant to the plaintiff's individual mental anguish under the wrongful death statute.
The key word is some, and I don't change that. I don't change that. There is some overlap. The court's flaw in its reasoning at, I'll give you the cite real quick. The court's flaw, and this gets to the crux, at page 773-74, the court said the problem as I see it is there is a great deal of overlap between the two. Mr. Elzevan said some before, and there is some. No one pursued what some meant.
Under your current theory, there's none.
No, there is some. For example, the dropping the body off of the gurney at the time of death when they picked her up to transport. I mean, there is some.
That was after death.
Okay, but it's at the death, at the death. And I would concede that that certainly would add to their anguish and the loss and watching what just had happened as they were taking the body away. But the point is no one pursued what the sum overlap is because the Superior Court judge believed that there was a great deal. There was no point in pursuing the limited overlap because the judge found 99.9% overlap. Excluded one thing, the dollar value, net worth value of Beebe and Lewis. And it was the only fact that was excluded from what could be argued to the jury. The jury could be told that they have a lot of money and that the family will put it to good use, and all those punitive type arguments, and we're told that. Only one fact was excluded.
You better save your last minute and a half.
I'm down to a minute and a half. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
May it please the court, Butler Daniel from North Carolina. I'm honored to be here. I've enjoyed this privilege to come up to Delaware and try this case, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here speaking before you today. As I listened to the argument by counsel, there were multiple liberties taken with the record, and I trust that Your Honors will read the record carefully, because you're going to see that there was no objection. There was no specific objection. The one limitation that the judge made was the one limitation they asked for, and I agreed to it. When they asked to leave, keep the numbers out, I said, I'm not going there. I agreed to it. That was the only opportunity either myself or the trial court had to rule on an objection. That was it. The defendants in this case made choices. They chose to create these facts that were horrific, that were unimaginable. They chose to, in the face of those facts, try this compensatory case to jury verdict. They didn't have to do that. They chose to do that. They recognized this potential overlap of evidence early on, 6 weeks before trial, in a written submission, and they chose to concede it. The court, in ruling on their motion for trialification, said, I recognize your concerns about prejudice, counsel, and here in Delaware we admit evidence for dual purposes often, and I am certainly willing to entertain any instructions you guys want to give me when you believe that any evidence in this case is crossing this line.
Why isn't the better practice to try the compensatory claim first and have the jury decide if the plaintiff is entitled to compensation, and then after they make that determination, decide whether the defendant should be punished? It seems a little difficult to do it all at one time and then sort it out with an instruction.
Well, and Your Honor, that is a fair question, and that was the subject of their motion for trialification, and that is that they believe the judicial economy, when weighed against the prejudice involved with the defendants, was considered that should have happened. But the Delaware case law that we argued to the court was that trifurcation and bifurcation should be sparingly granted, because a litigant has a right to go in and put on a cognizant, cohesive case, certainly when there is an overlap, as they had conceded in this case. And that was one of the points that the court relied on, was the conceded overlap of the evidence. Further, we argued the inconvenience to the plaintiffs of having experts have to come up on multiple occasions. We argued the traumatic effect that it would have on the plaintiffs on having to testify on multiple occasions. And the court could have granted their motion. The court certainly could have done that in its discretion, but it being the entity that was able to see the facts, hear the facts, and listen to counsel and read the briefs, made the call that the best way to proceed in this case is not trifurcation, it's one trial. And so, Judge, I'm not suggesting which is the better practice, but I think it's a case-by-case call that a trial court makes, and that's what they've been, and that was a call that was made in this case. When they chose not to draft the limiting instruction at the court's invitation, The defense counsel specifically chose a strategy to get up before the jury in their opening argument and instruct the jury that they are not to consider the punitive evidence as it relates to punitive damages. They said, just consider it as it relates to the family's mental anguish. That is what the defense counsel told the jury to do. They chose that strategy to ask the jury to focus their anger, focused their consideration of this punitive evidence, which was never defined, by the way. We've thrown around the punitive evidence in this case, in these briefs and in these arguments, but it has never been defined. To this day, they have never delineated where they contend that line to be, never, except for this extreme, how much you miss your mother and that she's no longer there to help, which is clearly not the law in Delaware. It's clearly not when you read the cases we've cited in our brief. So they chose to tell the jury to do that. They chose to leave this evidence undefined. They chose to settle the punitive damage claim when they did.
Well, you in your opening realized there was some overlap, and you had a lot of time to think about this. If there was no punitive claim at all, what evidence that came in at trial would not have come in your case?
Whatever the judge said, I'm not going to allow that to come in under mental anguish, Your Honor. I mean, counsel.
So you can't identify anything that will help this court?
Certainly, Judge. I believe that at trial, if the defense counsel had stood up in a pure compensatory claim case, and I said, Your Honor, I would at this point like to present my expert witness with the survey from December of 2003 where Ms. Ethel was left sitting in her chair for 6 hours. They never turned her, and she developed a pressure sore. And if counsel stood up and said, Your Honor, I object to that. That's going too far. That's clearly taking
it. So we would eliminate those prior instances where BB knew they had been unsuccessful in controlling Alzheimer's patients.
No, Your Honor. I'm not suggesting you eliminate all of them. I'm suggesting that the line to be drawn is one that is drawn not through judicial providence, not through a court opinion. The line that is drawn is one that is drawn through our procedure of trying a lawsuit, our procedure of going in and presenting the trial judge with an opportunity to make a call based upon an objection to a specific piece of evidence for a specific purpose. So I can't sit here before you and answer your question, frankly, and go through and tell you which evidence that I could advocate.
But you see, what we have to do is develop precedent. And what you're telling us is based upon the way this case was tried, there's a fairly clear demarcation that we can identify between what's a punitive case and what's the mental anguish that's compensatory, and this some overlap is something that someone can identify.
Judge, Your Honor, I'm sorry, Your Honor. Your Honor, I am not suggesting that there is a demarcation, specific demarcation that can be made. I'm suggesting that the rule of law has been established as in the Oki case. In the Oki case, the court there said, due to the infinite nature of mental anguish under the wrongful death statute, each case must be judged on its own facts.
Does that include, then, the litigation process, the anguish of having to come into court and testify about these events, or to deal with a lawyer who says, we're not settling this case, or we have a right to a jury trial and let a jury decide this case?
I don't think so. And if I was a trial judge, I wouldn't let the anguish of dealing with defense counsel and the anguish of having to come try your case before the jury, I wouldn't let that in.
All right. Now then, the next step then is, what about the facts that are learned through the litigation process?
Judge, I think there you're getting into a close call. I think you're getting into a call that the judge is going to look at it. The judge is going to look at the evidence, and he's going to say, well, here's my guidance that I have been providing. My guidance is that the facts and circumstances that occur as a result of this wrongful death and this wrongful act, they include facts and circumstances that could reasonably be anticipated to cause the beneficiaries to the wrongful death statute anguish. But the standard couldn't really go much further than that, and much further than what the courts did in West, Oki, when they defined mental anguish in the Oki case. I don't think that it's possible, based upon the reasoning in Oki, and that the fact that in any case, you don't know what is going to happen. You don't know what. The next case that comes through the courts here could be the man laying in the field bleeding to death from the shotgun.
Well
he may also have birds eating off of him.
Let's move from that amorphous argument to something a little more focused.
Yes, Your Honor.
The statute that deals with mental anguish refers, I think, to mental anguish resulting from the death. Now, the argument that's made here is that language limits the type of evidence and the facts that a jury can consider in determining the quality of the mental anguish and its dollar value. What is your legal argument to the effect that the other side's argument is wrong.
I don't know if you characterize this as a legal argument, Bob, but my
argument, we're here on a legal argument.
Well, my legal argument, Your Honor, is that, first of all, in the first paragraph of the statute, it refers to the injury resulting from the wrongful death.
Does it say wrongful death?
Yes, Your Honor. It says, in any action under this subchapter, damages may be awarded to the beneficiaries proportion to the injury resulting from the wrongful death. And then as it refers to mental anguish, it refers to mental anguish resulting from such death. And under the construction, strict or otherwise, of that statute, it would be our position that includes more than just the heart stopping, that the death constitutes something more. Death is not the mere fact of the heart stopping beating. The analogy I was going to use before the shotgun analogy was a young child stuck in a refrigerator in a Walmart. Dad's there in the Walmart, and he hears his child screaming from inside the refrigerator, choking and dying. And it torments him for the rest of his life. Well, his wife's at home, and she didn't see this horrific event.
Is it fair to say, then, that your argument at least would require the court or the jury to consider all the facts that relate to the wrongfulness of the death?
To the extent they cause mental anguish, and that's a reasonable you know, you can't say everything. You just can't. I can't stand here before you in the good faith and say everything should be considered, because it shouldn't. There are certain things it shouldn't. If my clients thought that all of the employees at BB were aliens, well, I can't put that on. That's unreasonable. It's irrational, and it's not foreseeable that anybody would think that. But yes, Your Honor, to answer your question, under their but-for argument and their perception of what death is, ignoring the facts, a jury is just left with such an impossible burden. Under their argument, a jury must somehow parse out the mental anguish that's clearly caused. No one disputes in this case that these events, what happened to this wife and mother caused them severe mental anguish. Under their argument, the jury must somehow parse that out. Say, okay, well, I got to parse that part out and only consider the proportion of their mental anguish that's really just resulting from the fact of death and the fact that we miss Mama and the fact that she's no longer there to help.
Is the net worth of every hospital going to be relevant now in a wrongful death claim, in the sense that this death could have been prevented if you had paid more money to get better doctors or more equipment or whatever, and as a result of that, the survivors have mental anguish?
No, Your Honor. I would submit absolutely not. I would submit that most trial judges would be correct to say, I am not going to let the plaintiff stand up here under the mental anguish provision in this statute and parade around the net worth of this defendant. I do not believe that would be something that a court would allow.
Didn't that happen here without the numbers?
No, Your Honor. Well, the net worth numbers were kept out because there was a specific motion made to keep that out after the settlement of the punitive damage claim. And there was the specific argument that that's not mental anguish, and I agreed to that.
Well, wasn't there an argument that the hospital made a deliberate decision not to expend the money to do what they had to do to protect the patients?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. I think that's a little different. That's where you get into the area where you begin to look to the trial courts to make their rulings. The questions were asked to the family members specifically. Tell the jury how this has affected you and how knowing how callous and unnecessary this death was has affected you. And they said, it makes it hard. It makes it hard to get over it. It makes it hard to move on. It was, and with that testimony, the trial court in this case felt and I can quote him. I've read the record so many times. He said, you know, the numbers aren't relevant, but the fact that they had the money to fix things and they just flat didn't, I think is a little more relevant. What say you, Mr. Elzafon? At no time was there any argument. At no time was there any opportunity taken to go, okay, well, Judge, when you offer me to look document by document, what should have happened is the defense counsel should have said, well, Judge, I would like to be heard with regards to the money they had to buy the new MRI that they didn't spend while fire hazards were piling up. They had money for an MRI. They bought a new MRI. They spent $500,000 on it. And meanwhile, they've got fire hazards in the halls at the LCC because they don't have storage space, and they didn't spend that money. Well, defense counsel could have said, Judge, I think that goes too far. I think that piece of evidence should not be considered. And I would make my argument, he would make his, and the judge would make the call. And
that based on what? The probative value is substantially outweighed by the danger of
unfair prejudice? I think that would be the appropriate analysis to apply to that question. I think it's relevant. That's what he said. He said, I think it's relevant. But I think, yes, Your Honor, that's the issue. Is that relevance outweighed by the probative value? And in some cases, marginal cases where there's weak evidence that this really caused these folks mental anguish, I think the judge would be in his discretion to say, I'm not going to let you go there, plaintiff's counsel. In other cases, I think the judge would be in his discretion to say that I'm going to allow that. I'm going to allow them to tell. I believe that this has caused them significant mental anguish. It's bad facts, but it's your facts. You created them, which is what the court said in this case. And I believe that it is relevant. And it is not outweighed by the prejudicial effect. Continuing on just this but-for argument and what a jury would have to do. The jury, when they hear the case where there is no concession of liability, when they hear the case of the person dying in the field from the shotgun blast, and when they hear, and that evidence is relevant for the purposes of liability, and under their argument that evidence is irrelevant for the purposes of pure mental anguish, and they hear about the effect that it had on the family when it, you know, the family talks about finding their loved one laying there bleeding to death and starts breaking down in tears and is clearly upset by it. It's clearly just that's the first time in all their testimony that they broke down. Under their argument, a jury is supposed to say, okay, well, we've got to figure out what this gentleman's grief is, and we have to somehow parse out the obvious fact that he's upset by what he saw in that field when he saw his loved one dying and laying there bleeding to death. And we would respectfully submit that is just neither consistent with common sense or the law or reality. In this state.
Your argument essentially would say resulting from such death includes the circumstances of the death, and that the mental anguish is going to change depending on whether it was a peaceful, wrongful death or a violent, wrongful death.
Precisely. That's what we're saying. And in some cases, whether the death was peaceful, truly negligent, truly inadvertent, or callous. And
has any other court adopted that view?
I have not found a case in the country where any other court has had this specific issue before them, where you're talking about a case where the family heard about the way a death occurred, and the defendants have come in and said that they should have never heard that or considered it as it related to the mental anguish. So I'm not aware of a case where this position has been taken, except for the cases that they refer to as the negligent infliction of emotional distress argument they make. They have a case where under a specific wrongful death statute and a much more expansive negligent infliction of emotional distress law than we have here in Delaware, and in a case where there was no specific purpose provision like 3725 that we have in this statute, none of those were present in that case. The court made that analysis when an argument was made that the two remedies, NIED and wrongful death, were somehow exclusive. But beyond that, I have not been able to find a case where these types of arguments were made. And while I'm discussing the negligent infliction of emotional distress
aspect of this case. The defendants in their brief, and I just want to point out one thing to your honors, say that the plaintiffs do not contest that if the principle of strict construction is applied, the wrongful death statute cannot be read to permit their argument.
Thank you, Mr. Daniel.
Oh, thank you very much.
Your honors, you're looking for a rule, and the rule that I would propose is that a jury not be instructed, as it was here, that everything that was considered for punitives is relevant to exacerbating mental anguish, but rather the jury must look at what grief would have occurred, would not have occurred but for the death, and was are the facts and circumstances proximately related to that grief, to the argument about that grief. And if anything is clear from this argument right now, it's that everything that this jury was allowed to consider about all of the bad acts, about obstructions in the hallway, flies in the kitchen, dementia, people falling, what the corporate board did or didn't spend money on, all those kinds of things, which is half of this record, should not have been considered, would not be considered under any mental anguish resulting from grief charge, even if you said the underlying circumstances can be considered. In terms of cases, this issue has been faced indirectly or directly, meaning it's fair to read Mullen in Arizona, Stump in West Virginia, the Maryland case cited in our brief, the Texas case Moore, 722 Southwest 2nd, 683, the Alaska case dealing with Dr. Kevorkian, 727 P. 2nd, 1038. And there is all kinds of testimony in this record that would be excluded even under what the plaintiff is asking for as a rule.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both. The court appreciates your argument. We will take this matter under advisement. We'll also take a brief recess.